coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And as always, it's so good to be with you again, covering right now the Global Humanitarian Conference going on October 21st through the 24th in Seattle, Washington. You can learn more about that at our website. On the right-hand side of your screen, click on the big IEEE. And those of you listening on radio can hear us commercial-free online at promiseoftomorrow.biz. First, going to lead off with Gordon Day, who's the president of IEEE, and then we're going to go to South Africa. We found him at Nelson Mandela University, Gershon von Stomp. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, visit our Fountain of Useless Information we have here on the set in the second half of the program, and, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's dial up Gordon Day.
Stand by.
Well, good news. We finally ran down Dr. Gordon Day. He's the 2012 IEEE president, and he's also the opening plenary keynote speaker at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference going on in Seattle in October 21st through the 24th. Welcome to the program, Dr. Day.
Thank you.
Now, you're the you're going to be the give the opening plenary keynote. Have you figured out yet what you're going to say?
Well, not exactly. I want to talk a little bit about sustainability and connect the extension of technology to the rest of the world, to the importance of providing energy as an enabling component of that, and as we do extend energy to parts of the world that don't have modern energy supplies, we need to really think about sustainability and providing that energy in a form that doesn't do bad things like damage our environment. Starting about a decade ago, mobile technology, cell phone technology, began to appear in developing countries, and that penetration grew very rapidly to the extent that I think the last data that I've seen suggests that nearly 80% of the people in developing worlds now have access to telephone technology. The same thing has not happened with electricity. And so we find, ironically, places where people have cell phones and have great difficulty in charging them, much less having access to lighting and other things that electricity would provide. And so the reasons for that are not completely clear, I think. Money is one piece of it. I've seen estimates that suggest if we were to try to get universal access to electricity within about 20 years, it would take an investment of in the neighborhood of $50 billion per year to do that. That sounds like a lot of money, but if you compare that to overall investments in energy, it isn't that big a percentage. So money is important. I think commitment is important, and all the other things that you can think of, about including governments and just logistics and all of those things. I think it's going to require, in the specific case of electricity, which I consider to be the enabling technology, going to require a group of solutions. In some cases, it means it will mean extending existing electric grids. In other cases, it will include probably require the development of small grids. They're sometimes called mini grids or micro grids. And then some of it will have to happen through off-grid solutions, such as local solar and wind power systems.
Well, Gordon, it's been suggested to me by some people that one of the problems with solving solutions such as you describe right there is bandits who will dig up the copper and the other things that it takes to deliver electricity, and until there's a good police situation or a good guardian situation, that it may not ever be able to happen.
Well, the price of copper has reached a level that it has become a target for theft all around the world. It happens in the United States. It happens in other developing countries as well as other developed countries as well as developing countries. So that is a problem. It's getting technology where technology has not been before involves a lot of problems, and they're all going to have to be solved as a package.
All right. Do you you want to put on the meditation cap for a minute and give us some sort of a prediction for the future? It could be frivolous. It could be something serious. 5 years out, 10 years out, 50 years out. What do you see when you really look forward down the road?
Well, one thing that's exciting me right now is that the United Nations has picked up the ball on this. They have declared 2012 to be the International Year of Sustainable Energy for All. And then Secretary General Ban Ki-moon came along and said to put some meat behind that designation, he was declaring an initiative, a UN initiative called Sustainable Energy for All. That initiative has three specific goals, all to be achieved by the year 2030. The first of them is universal access to modern energy. The second is doubling the rate of improvement of energy efficiency. And the third one is doubling the percentage of renewable energy in the world's energy mix. Those are very challenging goals to be achieved in, and now it would be 18 years. But there's been some analysis that suggests that it can be done. That number of $50 billion a year that I mentioned a few moments ago comes out of some of that analysis. It will take some engagement and commitment by governments. It will take companies working to achieve that. But I think there's some hope, and the list of commitments that have been made already and are likely to be made in the future give me some reason for optimism. For example, the European Commission has made a commitment to develop programs that would extend modern energy supplies to 500 million people. That's a good piece out of that 20%. The 20%, as you'll recall, 7 billion people in the world, is about 1.4 billion people who do not have modern energy access at this point. So 500 million is a significant chunk. Some other countries are stepping up. Some developing countries who have had programs already in place to extend modern energy supplies. Ghana comes to mind. Ghana has increased its access to access of its population to electricity to about 60 or 70% over just the last 10 or 15 years. They believe they can get to virtually 100% by the year 2020. So those kinds of commitments are coming in, and so you asked me to what my vision was. I would hope that those goals could indeed be achieved by 2030.
All right.
I think that what IEEE is doing and what the other engineering societies are doing, our partners in this conference, is really stepping up to address what I consider to be the unfinished business of my generation of engineers. And I'm really thrilled to see the profession defined broadly, not just the electrical engineering community, but the mechanical engineers, the civil engineers, the chemical engineers, all the way down the line, stepping up to address these problems.
All right, Dr. Gordon Day, the 2012 IEEE president and the opening plenary keynote speaker at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference of 2012, October 21st through the 24th in Seattle, Washington. You can learn more about that conference at our website. Go to promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link to the conference website, and you can learn all about it. Dr. Day, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
One of the outstanding speakers at that global humanitarian conference we've been speaking about is Gershon von Stomm. He is doing some remarkable things in Africa, and we had quite a chore in tracking him down, but we finally did. But the only way we could talk to him was by Skype, so bear with us a little bit, as sometimes the transmission is better than other times. But here we go. Where are you now? You're in Zimbabwe?
No, right now I'm in South Africa, in Port Elizabeth, on the south side of South Africa.
Oh, all right. That's a kind of a beautiful area, isn't it?
It is very beautiful. Have you been to Africa?
I have not, but I have many friends who have, and they tell me that it's pretty nice there. And you say you couldn't get a good landline there. Is that right, Gershon?
Yes, I'm a student also at the Nelson Mandela University. So that's where I am right now. I will be returning to Zambia next week. So I'm here to discuss with my professor and stuff. And I'm not at home here. And in my vicinity, I would not even know whether it would be a fixed phone. So
all right.
I have my own office, but I have no landline. And in the Zambian environment, I'm also not used anymore to landlines. We don't have them really.
I'm quite fascinated. I'm also fascinated with the fact that we're getting such a good reception with Skype because it goes up to the bird and then down to me, and there seems to be no delay. I'm hearing you quite immediately. Is that what you're getting on your end, too?
Yes, it's no problem. Actually, I'm using Skype all the time. I hardly use phone nowadays. Skype is really a way to go, huh?
That's your communication of choice. Well, that's pretty fascinating as far as I'm concerned. Now, you ordinarily live in Zimbabwe. Isn't that the old Rhodesia, the British colony of Rhodesia from years ago?
Yes, I live in Zambia, actually, which is northern Rhodesia. It's a country almost the size of Texas, or it's actually a little bit bigger, I think, than Texas.
I see. Now, who's in charge now? There's Robert Mugabe. The last I had heard, is he in Zimbabwe? Is that right?
That's indeed in Zimbabwe, but I do live in Zambia. That's President Sata, who was elected in last year with a peaceful election and a peaceful handover of power from the previous president to this one.
All right, that's fascinating. Well, anyway, you're a featured speaker at the humanitarian conference that IEEE is putting on in Seattle, Washington, the last week or so of October. And I'm fascinated with that. We're giving press coverage to it. And so I had wanted to speak with you and find out what it is you're going to present, what you're going to be talking about there. Can you help us out on that a little bit?
Of course, yes. It's a privilege to speak to you, and it's always wonderful to have long distance conversations, because we are bridging several cultures in that way, and that's what I'm going to talk about. You know, this is a fast shrinking world, and what is happening in this world? Basically, it's about the question if technology is the solution to the world's major social challenges. Of course, we have major challenges in the world, and many people are asking all kinds of tough questions. But when we think about the third world or the developing world, the questions are even more pronounced. And there's a lot of questions being asked of development and what development is, and how technology can be facilitating that development. And so the question is whether or not technology is the solution to the world's major social challenges. And I want to propose it's not. Actually, to think that technology can solve the world's major social challenges is a myth. And some people believe in that myth, so they are going to try to find the technical solution to the world's problems. And if we search them like that, we will fail, and we have failed. But when we work together over the borders and within cultures, we will succeed. And it's a privilege to speak to the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference of IEEE. And of course, IEEE is the biggest professional institute in the world. And so the benefit of that is that there are members of IEEE, responsible members, all over the world, and also in Africa. So I would like to plead to the conference that we work together as IEEE worldwide, and that nobody thinks he's better than somebody else, but that we really work together. So if we do that, then we will learn from each other, and then we can see how technology can support the development in the world, because it can. It is an it amplitudes human intent, but by itself it doesn't solve anything. It's about people, and it's always about people.
Well, Gershon, I want to drill down. I want to drill down on that just a little bit, if we can. The conference, of course, is titled the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, all about solving the problems of the humanitarian problems with the technology. And you say that that's out the window, that the technology solutions aren't there. You're very adamant about that. Why do you feel that technology cannot solve the problems of the developing world?
There is no cause and effect that when you bring in a technology, it solves the major social challenges. Of course, it supports solving. It's a serving thing. Technology doesn't serve, but it doesn't lead. So in that respect, it has to have its proper place, and it's in the cooperation with other disciplines. That it can be very effective in supporting solving problems, but in itself it cannot.
Well, I see that you in your bio here you work with local talent this is a quote now, engender transdisciplinary practices and holistic theory building. Now, I am totally lost in that jargon. Can you please help us understand exactly what it is you're trying to say?
It's what I mean with that we work together. So technology is part of one discipline in science. Mm-hmm. It's applied sciences. It's the natural sciences. But we need other sciences also. So you could also say multidisciplinary. But basically, we need all sciences together to tackle the very complex problems that this world has. And that working together, the methodology to do that is now called transdisciplinary activities. So it means actually to include all the disciplines, not just count the amount of disciplines that work together, but that the solution that we are trying to implement together is being informed by all possible information, all possible inputs from all possible disciplines. That is what transdisciplinary activities means. Holistic, that means that it takes into account everything. For instance, when there is a situation in rural Zambia, that's where I live, that situation has many, many aspects. Of course, it needs technology to a certain extent to solve certain needs, but most of the time it depends on the people, if that is possible, and the context. So we have to be sensitive to the culture, the way how people behave with each other, and the context, the specific context with its availabilities and non-availability of certain services and so on, that we have to approach holistically. If we just look at a certain discipline and a certain need, and only devise a solution for that need, for that discipline, we are prone to fail. So it needs a holistic approach.
Well, I'm reminded many times of the words of Mahatma Gandhi when he said famously, God comes to a starving man in the form of bread. And so I'm told over and over and over again that what is needed in the developing world is refrigeration, power, water, and those sorts of things. But you're taking a more esoteric view of things. What exactly does your work entail there? And I incidentally, I seem to notice, I believe you're originally from, you're Dutch, aren't you? From the Netherlands, and you've been in Africa since 2000. So you and your family have been working there. What have you been doing?
Yeah, thank you. I have actually been traveling forth and back to Africa since 87. Part of my education in engineering in the Netherlands, which is in radio analog techniques, I did a elective in Swaziland. That's how I started to get to know the African side. I was involved also in South Africa in 94, but we live here full-time in the rural area of Africa since 2000. 2 years in Zimbabwe, and now a good 9 years in Zambia. The work, what we do in, first of all, is we live with the local community, and if through living together, we get to know each other. And most importantly, you know, for us and for me, is to get to know the community and to understand what the needs could be, and to learn from them how the world is being viewed through the local culture. It takes a lot of time. So 9 years is actually rather short to be able to sort of assess and to be of support to the local community and their needs. And the only thing I think I might be doing is mentoring. Because I think the ideas, they grow locally, like everywhere in the world. Entrepreneurs in the United States, they live in the United States. There are no people in Zambia thinking about how to entrepreneur in America. So the question is if people in America can think how to entrepreneur in Zambia. But the people in Zambia do know, and we have to learn to listen to them and to understand how they express their ideas. And when those ideas, when we can be of any support, and we have any knowledge in where the void is, then we can implement safe technology and train people in how to implement and how to use it. But it all comes from the local community. Through that, there's a big organization has grown, now called Macha Works, and it does lots of things. As we talked before about holistic approach, it starts with the internet. Because without internet, there is no flow of information. In rural Africa, which is far away from anywhere, you know, to get information is a huge challenge. In the area where I live, there are no radio waves coming in from outside. There is no way that a newspaper can make it because it's just far away from everywhere. And 94% of Zambia's surface is called rural. So that's where the rural conditions is far. You know, it's just huge. So started with internet, so it was information. We started with means of transport, and actually with support of other technologies, we started flying airplanes, so there was an ability to get to the camp a bit faster and safer. Lost people that died during transport, and we have started energy solutions, trying to build grow fuels ourselves. We have had interventions in education, because that education in primary, secondary, working with the universities and doing vocational education. And lots of other things that all grew out of local demand, local people that wanted to do things but did not have the ability or the resources to do so. And by being together, we could enhance ability to do things. And out of that grew all kinds of interventions, of which the internet intervention is the most known network that is built people. But there are many, many other things that also happen which do not get so much of the spotlight.
Well, I've been given the cue, we have to take a break, but we'll be back to expand more on that thought right after this. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour. We're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
I am not a stranger to this den. You know me. I'm Fred. Fred Malik. Use your intellect to inform your instincts. But trust your instincts.